From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, two of the greatest jazz performers of our time. We'll hear from tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins, the musician some critics consider the greatest living jazz improviser, and Betty Carter, one of the most original singers in jazz. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has voted overwhelmingly to confirm Stephen Breyer as the nation's new Supreme Court justice. The vote was 87-9. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The 55-year-old Breyer is a federal appeals court judge in Boston, whom the president nominated to replace the retiring Justice Harry Blackmun. Most members of the Senate were lavish in their praise for Breyer. Utah Republican Orrin Hatch called him a man of immense qualifications and immense integrity. Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy, Breyer's sponsor, said the San Francisco-born jurist has demonstrated an outstanding intellect, unquestioned integrity and temperament, and a deep and abiding commitment to the Constitution and the rule of law. All 9 of the votes against Breyer came from Republicans. Some questioned whether he had been forthcoming during his confirmation hearings about his investments. Others said he was not conservative enough. Breyer is likely to be sworn in a few days to give him some time to prepare for the fall term of the court that begins in October. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
An anti-abortion activist opened fire in a Florida abortion clinic today, killing a doctor in a bulletproof vest and his volunteer escort. The escort's wife was wounded. The gunman was arrested immediately outside the Pensacola clinic. A shotgun was also recovered. Both victims were shot in the head. The victims include 69-year-old Dr. John Britton. His security escort, 74-year-old James Barrett, died at the scene, too. Britton's wife, 68-year-old retired nurse June Britton, was struck in the arm. She is hospitalized in fair condition. Britton had traveled to Pensacola to perform abortions ever since the murder of Dr. David Gunn last year. Former Italian Prime Minister Bettino Craxi has been convicted of fraud and sentenced to 8.5 years in prison. NPR Silvio Pugioli reports from Rome.
Bettino Craxi, whose government in the early 80s set an Italian record for longevity, is the first major politician of the country's disgraced old guard to be convicted in a corruption trial. He was found guilty of fraudulent bankruptcy in connection with the collapse of the infamous Banco Ambrosiano a decade ago. The body of the bank president, Roberto Calvi, was found hanging from a London bridge in 1982, and the case is still enveloped in mystery. Craxi, who is in Tunisia claiming he is too ill to return to Italy, faces 3 other corruption trials and about 20 different probes into illegal financing of political parties through extortion. A Rome magistrate has given him until early September to return to Italy, or else an international arrest warrant will be issued. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros is being sued by his former mistress. Linda Medlar accuses him of fraud and breach of contract. She says Cisneros has stopped making $4,000 monthly payments as part of an agreement they reached 4 years ago. This is NPR. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 31 points at 3,761. Trading is heavy. The government is sending the Marines to Washington State to help fight fires there. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy says 2 battalions of Marines from Camp Pendleton will fly to help relieve crews fighting a 54,000-acre blaze. That fire is so hot, firefighters can't get close enough to start putting it out. They can't even reach it by air because of flame-induced turbulence. Fires are still burning as well in Oregon, Utah, Montana, and Idaho. Mike Espy says almost 2 million acres have been consumed by fires this season, and he says many of them were started by people, not lightning. Olympic volleyball games won't be played in Cobb County, Georgia. Gay rights activists had fought the venue because the county adopted an anti-gay resolution last year. Melinda Weir of member station WUGA reports.
Following months of controversy, the Atlanta Committee for the Olympic Games today announced the removal of volleyball preliminaries from suburban Cobb County, Georgia. The games will now be played in the city of Athens, which is 60 miles away. Nearly a year ago, Cobb County commissioners approved a resolution that condemns the so-called gay lifestyle. Since then, gay rights advocates around the U.S. started a boycott and called for the removal of Olympic events from Cobb County. Officials at the University of Georgia, where the volleyball preliminaries will now be held, say they're not involved in the politics of the issue, but are pleased to have been chosen as the new site. For National Public Radio, I'm Melinda Weir.
The judge in the O.J. Simpson case has set a tentative trial date for September 20th. This date can be changed depending on how much progress is made in dealing with evidence. Lawyers in the double murder trial are trying to divide up evidence that must be tested. Defense lawyers are pressing the prosecution to share. Prosecutors say they will meet with O.J. Simpson's lawyers to provide as much information about the evidence as they can. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of our show, we have an interview from early this year with a jazz musician who may have no living equal, Sonny Rollins. Rollins started recording in the late 40s and played with the musicians now in the pantheon of modern jazz, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, Miles Davis, Max Roach, and Clifford Brown. Music critic Francis Davis wrote this about Rollins: when conjuring up an image of the quintessential jazz man, heroic, inspired, mystical, obsessed, as often as not, it is Rollins we picture. Rollins is the greatest living jazz improviser. He may be the greatest virtuoso that jazz has ever produced. This is Sonny Rollins soloing on Skylark, recorded in 1972.
Monk said to me one time that if it wasn't for music, life wouldn't be worthwhile living. I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing what he said, but you know, if I don't play for a little while, I get physically sick. You know, if I don't play my horn for a while, for a few days or whatever, I actually begin to get sick, and I wonder, well, gee, what's the matter with me? Then I realize, well, I haven't played my horn for a few days.
When you're performing and you're improvising, are you thinking?
Well, no, not really. No, I don't think. That's why I really practice and I keep these exercises and so on, because when I'm actually on the stage and performing, the optimum condition is not to think. I just want the music to play itself. I don't want to have to think about it. If I have to think about what I'm doing, then the moment is already gone, you know?
Are you analyzing what you're playing as you're doing it, saying, oh, this is good, or, oh, I don't like this. I've got to find something that's working better?
When I'm really playing at my best, I can hear what I'm doing, but after it's done, but I can't hear it while I'm doing it. And there are some occasions when I really can stand back mentally and sort of listen to myself play. The music just plays itself. I'm just a person standing there with the, moving my fingers and so on. And there are certain times when actually it's an out-of-body experience, so to speak.
What do you do when you practice now? I mean, you're a brilliant player. You're a veteran player. I think a lot of people of your stature would probably just perform and not exactly practice anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you play a reed instrument, I mean, it might be true with other instruments as well, but when you play a reed instrument, you have to deal with your embouchure, which is the position of your lips around your teeth and the instrument and the mouthpiece of the instrument. And this has to form a sort of a cushion. And if you don't play for a while, what will happen is that your lips would bleed when you play, and even split. Your lip might split. It's happened to me when I've had to lay off for a period of time. For other things, I'm not certain. I practice a lot of things, but I read once where my friend Max Roach said that a lot of musicians shouldn't really practice. Practicing is cheating after you reach a certain point. So that may be right, but in the case of just keeping my embouchure from bleeding and my lip from splitting, I like to play a certain amount every day, you know.
Sonny Rollins is my guest. One of the things that I love about your playing is your repertoire, the songs that you choose to play. And you have a really diverse repertoire, and you play a lot of old pop songs that many people don't know or have forgotten, as well as some songs that are like novelty songs, like, you know, Tootsie and I'm an Old Cow Hand, and Noel Coward songs. Are these a lot of these songs you grew up with?
Yeah, a lot of them are songs that I heard when I was a youngster. When I was growing up, the big thing to do every week was go to the movies on Saturday. And on Saturday, we used to see a lot of these movies that had this scores in it, you know, by some of the composers. And we'd see Louis Armstrong and pictures and different musical personalities that I enjoyed a lot. Of course, I also heard music around the house and so on, but the movies did provide a certain large part, I think, of some of the things that I play today, you know.
When you started performing, was it hard to find other musicians who liked the same songs you did and who wanted to play them? I mean, even back in the days when you were playing with Miles Davis or with Clifford Brown, did they share your musical taste?
I would say, basically, yes. People like Coltrane and Clifford Brown, we all had an appreciation of what they would call today the standard songs. It is, in my case, I might have found some more obscure songs.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, like, propose playing something like Tootsie and have other musicians look at you like you were crazy?
Well, they might have thought so, but they wouldn't dare to say it.
Well, why don't we pause here?
It was my gig, you know.
Right, right. Why don't we pause here and play your recording of There's No Business Like Show Business? Sonny Rollins, recorded in 1955. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ back with tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins. His latest album is called Old Flames. You grew up in Harlem, in New York. And your parents, I believe both of your parents, were from the Virgin Islands?
That's right.
What were your parents' ambitions for you? Did they push you to excel when you were young?
Yeah, well, I was the youngest child. I have an older brother who was a very fine classical violinist. He ended up being a physician. Then I had an older sister who was also sang a lot in church and everything. And so I was supposed to follow in their footsteps. Of course, I didn't because I was somewhat of a black sheep. They were much more studious than I. And I wanted to hang out and play ball. And as the years went on, I was really the guy that was out going to jazz clubs and all that. These things were frowned on at that time.
The jazz life, when you started to play, actually had a lot of heroin involved with it.
Right.
And you got involved with that for a while when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you would have tried something like that if it weren't for it being such a part of the jazz world in the 50s?
I don't think I would have actually. There would really have been no reason, I don't think, to get involved with that. I got involved with it because a lot of my idols were doing it and so on, so we thought that using drugs was sort of the thing to do. But this is something like asking whether Billie Holiday would be the singer she is if she didn't use drugs. I've had this discussion often with people. And my answer is that, yes, I think Billie Holiday would be the singer she is regardless of what happened to her. I mean, even though she may sing about hard times and all that, she was a consummate musician and beautiful singer. So, yes, I think that she would sing the way she did. Charlie Parker would play the way he did. Everybody would do what they did.
It must have been your parents' worst nightmare when you entered the jazz world and then started using.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my mother was pretty, since I was a baby, my mother really, she stuck by me regardless of what I did. She was really in my corner. But I had a lot of problems from the rest of my family. My father, my grandmother, they really were pretty down on me. And my siblings, they didn't really understand where I was coming from anyway. But I have to say that my mother really believed in me all the way. And I'm really happy that I was able to get myself together before she left the scene. So she kind of saw me start to make records and so on like that. So I sort of made her feel that her trust wasn't exactly all in vain, you know.
Were you ever arrested?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I was arrested. Unfortunately, I had to get involved with the justice system and all of this stuff, you know. But I was always lucky because I was able to get involved with music programs.
In the prison?
Right. And in those days, there were other musicians there, you know, so.
Did it scare you when you were in prison? Did you say to yourself, like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, it scared me a lot. It scared me a lot. But, again, I was lucky because I could play an instrument. And,
right.
And a lot of the other prisoners knew of me, so I immediately had respect from them.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, being locked up is no joyride.
How did you straighten out?
Well, it took a little while, but I slid back a couple of times and everything. But I eventually had gotten down to the complete bottom. So I couldn't have gotten any worse, you know. I mean, I was really in a complete.
What was the bottom?
Well, the bottom was sleeping park cars in garages and all that stuff, you know, and what we used to call in those days carrying the stick. Carrying the stick meant that you were homeless. I guess today they would just say a guy is homeless. But I did this mainly when I was in Chicago. Chicago was where I was sort of was out there on my own. In New York, even though I was persona non grata at home, I could always perhaps get by or sneak in the house or something. But when I was really away from home, I really had to pay a lot of dues, as we used to say.
How would you protect your horn during the periods when you were homeless?
Well, I didn't protect my horn. I mean, I didn't have a horn, really.
Were you borrowing other people's horns?
I was borrowing other people's horns, yeah.
What did you learn about yourself during that period?
Well, what I learned about myself? Well, I learned that I had the strength to get over something, which was really deep. And I think one of the things that I always feel good about myself was that I was able to overcome that, because I really had to struggle. You know, when I came away from the hospital one time and I went back to the nightclub, it was really the classic scene of the old drug pushers standing there saying, "Come on, man, come on, you know, and this is good." And I really went through the classic scene of fighting myself, you know, saying, "Well, gee, if I go with them, it wouldn't be so bad. It's just one time, and maybe I should do it, and why not?" And this, and then that's the other part of me saying, "No, don't do it." You know, I mean, the real classic battle between good and evil, right and wrong, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, I won out, you know, and that's one thing that I really feel good about myself. You know, I really went into the lion's den and came out alive. And then after that, it increasingly got easier and easier to say no to drugs, which was really a debilitating thing for people to do.
Once you found that strength and knew that you had it, how else were you able to use it in your life?
Well, then I felt I could do anything, you know, and I could get back to what I really wanted to do, which was my music.
So how do you use that strength in your music?
Well, I don't know. I think I always had had strength in my music, even when I was a kid, and I used to practice for hours and hours and hours at a time. I mean, I always had something within myself which enabled me to be alone and play and get into what I'm doing and not think about anything else and really get into this stuff myself. So actually, by getting rid of these negative elements, I was just able really to return to what I had in the beginning, you know.
Tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins is my guest. Over the years, you've taken several hiatuses. There have been several periods where you haven't performed, and I think one period like that lasted, was it 5 years? Was that the longest?
It's hard to say. I took a hiatus on the bridge, which was pretty well documented.
Right, this was during the period when you were practicing on the Williamsburg Bridge in New York because it was too loud for you to practice in your apartment.
Right.
So, but what were some of the reasons that have led you during different times of your career away from performing?
Well, there was also a period when I ran into a lot of difficulty with the powers that be in the music business. I mean, I was looked upon as sort of a person that was hard to get along with. Somehow I got that reputation, I guess, because I tried to demand a certain amount of money, or I didn't want to be messed around like a lot of guys or whatever, but I've always dealt with that during my whole career in one way or another.
So when you take a hiatus, when do you know it's time to get back to performing?
Well, when I took my hiatus on the bridge, it became apparent because I had sort of gotten what I wanted to do. I was trying to really accomplish something musically, and I'd sort of gotten close enough to what I was doing that I felt if I stayed there, it might have turned into a self-indulgence, and that's not what it was about. Mm-hmm. So I'd sort of gotten to that point when I realized, well, it's time to come back. I didn't accomplish everything that I wanted to, but I felt I accomplished enough that I proved the point to myself.
I'd love to know what it feels like to play your horn on the Williamsburg Bridge. And this was the period when you weren't performing, but you were practicing a lot on the bridge, I guess in the middle of the night?
Well, yeah, we played in the night and in the daytime anytime. It was actually a beautiful place to play because it was a nice space up there. You were really on top of the subway. The trains that came across the bridge were underneath you.
You were on the pedestrian walk?
Yeah, the pedestrian walk. So it's really a nice space up there, and you're sort of right in the middle of everything. You can see the Manhattan and on the other side Brooklyn, and the boats would be coming by at night, and you could blow as loud as you want, and nobody would even look at you. You know, every now and then people would walk by, but nobody would even look. You know, I mean, this was the sophistication of New Yorkers.
Yeah, New Yorkers are immune to everything. do you think your sound got bigger during that period?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it did have certain good effects, really.
Do you feel that you're living the life that you're supposed to be living now? You know, performing when you want to perform, living in the country in New York with also an apartment in Manhattan. I mean, do you feel that you've designed the right life for yourself?
Yeah, I feel I've designed the right life for myself. However, as I'm getting older, I'm beginning to feel that I want to perform more. You know, as Count Basie said, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon now for me. So it's a lot of time now when I might be off for 6 weeks or so. And I'm beginning to feel now that I'd like to be playing a little more because there's less time. Let me put it that way. There's less time for me to do everything that I want to do.
You feel you're getting older and you want to get in as much as you can.
As much as I can. Yeah. So I have to sort of temper my strategy a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, knowing that you'll be performing more is actually very good news. I'm really glad to hear that. It's just been a pleasure to talk with you. We've been wanting to talk with you on the show for so long.
Thanks, Sarah, so
much for doing it. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Sonny Rollins recorded last February. His latest album is called Old Flames. Tomorrow he performs at the Utah Jazz and Blues Festival. In September he'll perform at the Hollywood Bowl and the Monterey Jazz Festival. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition, a 1990 interview with jazz singer Betty Carter.
Plain chops and roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with string. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudel, devour sleigh bells and schnitzels with noodles. Walkies that fly with the moon on their wing. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses and new satin sashes, snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes, silver white winters that melt into spring. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stephen Breyer has won easy Senate confirmation to become the newest Supreme Court justice. The vote was 87-9. He'll succeed retiring Justice Harry Blackmun and take his seat when the court opens this October. All votes against Breyer were cast by Republicans, but he did receive support from 33 Republican lawmakers. President Clinton is asking Congress for more help for Rwandan refugees.
Today, I have requested that Congress immediately provide $320 million in emergency relief assistance. I commend Chairman Obie, Chairman Byrd, Senator Leahy, and their colleagues for their swift action yesterday in support of the initial $50 million of these funds. If Congress approves the balance of our request, this would bring total United States assistance since April to almost $500 million.
The president says U.S. officials are trying to decide whether to open a new airfield in Kigali, Rwanda, to help dispense the relief aid. Meanwhile, French troops in Rwanda are beginning to go home. They'll be replaced by African soldiers. French officials say about 300 soldiers will leave by Sunday, this despite pleas from the United Nations to stay. A French government spokeswoman says the African troops will work under a United Nations flag. France hasn't decided if it will go on pulling its troops out of Rwanda, even if there aren't any African troops to replace them. Fires are scorching more land in Oregon, Washington, and California. Firefighting resources are stretched to the limits. Fires have also erupted near Crater Lake, Oregon's only national park. Jay Marble of Jefferson Public Radio reports from Ashland, Oregon.
Since last weekend's lightning storms, as many as 15 fires have been spotted at the park. The latest and largest is the Desert Ridge Fire. Officials say this is a difficult fire to fight because of steep terrain and because it's so isolated. David Gress is a fire information officer at the park. He says the old-growth pine and hemlock in the area also create extreme fire conditions.
The problem is that we've had a lot of mortality either due to old age or insects in that area, and a lot of trees are falling over and they're down and they're just ready to burn.
Because of the fire's location and lack of fire crews, air tankers and helicopters are the main tools used in battling the Desert Ridge Fire. As other fires in the region are controlled, it is hoped more crews and equipment will be available. For National Public Radio, I'm Jay Marble in Ashland, Oregon.
The government says the gross domestic product ran at about 3.7% for the second quarter of this year. The Commerce Department says a buildup in business inventories fueled the growth of the GDP. On Wall Street, stock prices moved up today. The Dow gained more than 33 points to end at 3,764. Advancing issues led declines. This is NPR. A hospital in Belfast, Northern Ireland, says it's treated 35 people who were hurt after a mortar bomb hit a police station in a suburb. Most of the cases involved cuts and shock. Police say three mortar rounds were launched from the back of a truck. Two landed in the police station, a third went astray and hit an electrical store across the street. A hospital spokesman says eight of the injured are police and British soldiers. The rest are civilians from a nearby shopping center. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. The International Atomic Energy Agency has rejected claims that North Korea has five atomic warheads. The Vienna-based group has also rejected the claim that Pyongyang is going to make five more. Peter Hoffer reports.
News of North Korea's successful atomic bombs production was announced earlier this week in Seoul by a high-level defector who fled to South Korea 2 months ago. But in Vienna, the International Atomic Agency says this report is not plausible. The Atomic Agency has been controlling most of North Korea's atomic plants, although its inspectors were refused access to two nuclear facilities, and this set off the crisis between North Korea and the United Nations. It was only after the visit of former President Carter to Pyongyang that the North Koreans announced they would freeze their atomic program pending talks with the United States. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Hoffer in Vienna.
Former Italian Prime Minister Bettino Craxi has been sentenced to 8.5 years in prison for his conviction on fraud charges. Craxi was a leading figure in the ongoing Italian corruption probe. He was not in court today to hear the sentence. He's been convicted in connection with the collapse of an Italian bank 10 years ago. The ruling against Craxi can be appealed. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we have a 1990 interview with Betty Carter. Fresh Air jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has written, "No arguments, please. Betty Carter is our greatest living jazz singer." New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliett said of Betty Carter, "She stretches time even further than Billie Holiday. She has in recent years begun to scat sing a great deal, and she has no match among the living, or perhaps among the dead." Let's start with a song from her now classic album, Inside Betty Carter, recorded in 1964.
This isn't sometimes, this is always. This isn't maybe, this is always. Yeah. It's love, the real beginning of forever. This isn't just midsummer madness, a passing glow, a moment's gladness. This is love, anew it on the night we met. You tied a string.
Do you actively look for songs, or do they just happen to you? I don't mean songs you've written, but songs that you add to your repertoire.
No, I really look for songs that are a little different, because you can't find them, you know. So I really go out and look for songs that haven't been overexposed by other singers. And I try to stay away from songs that have been sung a singer has become well-known with. I try to lay off of that particular song.
It's amazing how a good singer like you can take even a song with sentiment that might seem corny on the page and make it really come to life.
Well, if it's a corny lyric, then it's the music I like. And I put them together that way.
Having your own label, did that make you, having your own label made you independent, gave you the freedom to record what you wanted to record without a record company intervening and saying, no, add this, sing that. It also made you into a businesswoman. What else did it do, having being that independent?
Well, it just, what it taught me was that I had to do what I had to do. It wasn't that I had any problems with record companies. It was the way the environment was running at the time. Record companies were not interested in really dealing with jazz artists. I wasn't the only person that was without a jazz label. There were a lot of jazz people that had the bigger names than mine and didn't have a major jazz label, a major label. I just thought I had to do what I had to do. I was told by a lady friend of mine in Jersey to do it myself, and she said, do it yourself, and I decided, well, okay, I'll do it myself and see what happens. And it was a slow process because I tried not to sell records on the job. I really wanted people to go to the record shops and ask for the record. I didn't really want to come off of a job and have a stack of records outside and selling them that way, so I avoided that.
Why did you want to avoid that? A lot of jazz musicians have a display of their records at the back of the room that they're playing.
I know that. I don't know why I didn't like that as much as a lot of other people do, but it was just something that I just couldn't do. And so I just wanted the people that wanted my records to go to the record shop and inquire about a record from Betty Carter, and then maybe the record shop would try to find out where he can get a Betty Carter record and put him in the shop. I really wanted my records in the shop. So the only way to do that was to create a demand. So that's what I tried to do.
Let me play something else from your new album, Dropping Things. And this is the Rodgers and Hammerstein song, What's the Use of Wondering? And
right.
It's from Carousel, isn't it?
Right.
Tell me why you chose the song. This is another example. This happens to me all the time, that there's a song that I really never cared much for, and suddenly I hear... Well, in this case, I hear you sing, and I say, hey, this song is really fine. It's beautiful the way you sing it.
Why didn't you care for it? Because of the lyrics, right?
I think it might be because of the movie of Carousel. I don't...
Well, the lyrics are pretty much, most females wouldn't want to sing lyrics like this because it really caters to the man completely, you know. But the melody is so great, and I just think that people are missing out on this beautiful tune if it's not sung by more people, you know? And I changed the key in the bridge, you know, which I had to do in order to make it sound good to me, you know? So I think that's probably the reason why you like it.
What's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? If you like the way he wears his hat, what's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? He's your fella.
That's Betty Carter from her album Dropping Things. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Betty Carter. Now, you sat in with Lionel Hampton one night. I think this was after you graduated high school. And based on that, he hired you. You sang with his band a couple of years. There were several singers in the band at that time. Was there a kind of number that you specialized in?
Yeah, I improvised all the time. It wasn't any particular number. I just improvised all the time. Anytime he wanted to put me in a song to improvise, he would let me do it.
You've said that you would have, at the time, preferred to be in, say, Dizzy Gillespie's band.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, it seemed like Hampton was the right place to be. Why?
Because it was better organized, and I got paid every week. And it was well-run, and I had the role model of his wife that I didn't realize at that time was a real role model, because she was the person who was in control of the orchestra.
This is Gladys Hampton.
Right.
Were there ever things that you were expected to do that you didn't want to do when you were performing with the Hampton Band?
That I was expected to do? No, there were some things I wanted to do that I wasn't allowed to do or wasn't able to do. And that was to really sing some songs, you know. But Ham thought I could improvise better, so that's what he had me do.
Did you ever feel... earlier in your career that there were a lot of musicians who didn't take singers seriously and who didn't think that they were the equals of musicians, of instrumentalists?
Well, you must remember that the jazz world is dominated by men.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, men tend to think that they know more than most women, period. so let's not even put it in just the music business at all, you know. But since they did dominate the field of music, and they are and still are the innovators, we must give them that kind of respect. Now, it's up to us as females, and we're getting there now, to take on this challenge and have them realize that we have talent also. A lot of us were really afraid to get out there and deal with men on the same level, but now we're doing that.
Let's talk a little more about your style of singing.
Oh.
You got started, you know, in the Hampton Band doing a lot of improvisation and stuff.
Right.
Now, when you sing a song, you often improvise on the melody.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean scat. I mean just.
Oh no.
Just
The melody has changed a little bit. Like you may have thought that I changed. What the use of wondering is? You know. I know what you mean.
How did you start developing that?
Yeah, you know, as you get older, your voice does change. And if you don't want to change keys, you better do something. You know? If you don't want to drop your key, then you'd better know what to do to compensate in keeping it in the same key. For instance, a lot of the songs I sing today are in the same key I sang them in 25 years ago. So my voice isn't as thin and as light as it was 25 years ago. It's heavier, it's thicker. So I have to challenge myself now. What can I do to compensate for all these things? So then by doing that, you only educate yourself and you learn more about you, what you can, your capabilities, what you can do. And you find that you can do a whole lot of things. The breathing becomes different. Holding notes become different. Going from high to low becomes different. So you have to adjust to this. There's one song that I've been wanting to do for years, and the only way I'm going to ever do this song is to change key. And I refuse to do it because I don't want to change keys. I'm just stubborn enough to not want to change keys.
Well, what's wrong with changing keys? Why are you so attached to one key? Do you see it as a failure?
It's brighter. I think that what it's done for me is make me fight for my sound. It makes me fight for my throat, to be a better singer, to be a stronger singer. If I adjust, I'm making it easy for myself. So if I change keys, I'm making it easier for myself. So if I don't change keys, I've got to reach for something. So this keeps me reaching for something.
Betty Carter is my guest. A couple of years ago, an album was reissued that was a real collector's item in the jazz world. I mean, I'm thinking of the album of duets you recorded with Ray Charles.
Right.
To give our listeners a sense of how much in demand this was, I mean, the most beat up, unlistenable copy of it would sell for like $60 or $80.
You know? That was terrible.
Yeah.
That was terrible. Awful.
So you know, now it's available on CD and on record again. I want to play something from the album of duets that you recorded with Ray Charles. And this is Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Ooh.
Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Well, it's a song that I never thought I would ever sing, that's for sure.
Why? You know,
I just never thought I would ever sing it. And I never thought it would really be a favorite song for people these days. I mean, I really didn't believe it would really catch on this and stay alive this long where people, wherever I work, without Ray Charles, people ask me to sing Baby, It's Cold Outside. It's really weird, you know?
You think it's a very slight song?
No, it's not that. It's just that I never dreamed that it would be this effective.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just never thought it would be this effective, that people would ask me to do it by myself.
Okay, well, here it is. Baby, It's Cold Outside, performed by my guest Betty Carter with Ray Charles, recorded in 1960.
Outside.
I've got to go away.
Betty, it's cold out there.
This evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hand. They're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful
worry.
Beautiful. what's your hurry?
And Father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to that fireplace
roar. So really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Maybe just a half.
Why don't you put some records on while I pour?
And the neighbors might think.
That's Betty Carter and Ray Charles. We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Betty Carter in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight, President Clinton asking Congress for $320 million for Rwanda. And he restates that U.S. troops would only be used there for humanitarian activities. Other stories, Mary Kay Magstad reports on the efforts to get clean water into the refugee camps in Goma, Zaire. A new Democratic plan for health care in the House. Employers would pay 80% of workers' health insurance. I'll talk with Kurt Schork, a reporter in Sarajevo, about conditions there after the Bosnian Serbs have shut down the last major supply route into the city. Also, Andre Kadrescu on traveling to France and singer-songwriter Peter Case on traveling and singing.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is singer Betty Carter.
I think a lot of singers probably had bands put together for them or trios put together for them. You've always hired your own musicians.
Oh, yeah.
How do you find the musicians who you hire? You often find young musicians who then go on to, you know, careers of their own, but you often find people who no one knows yet. No one knows yet.
Well, I at one time used musicians that people knew, but as I grew older, I felt that I needed something young under me. I needed some energy under me. I really felt like Art Blakey felt about youth inspiring you, giving you the enthusiasm that you need to stay on top of things, to stay young and stay fresh. So I started hiring young musicians about 15 to maybe 16, 17 years ago. And when the word gets out that you will hire young musicians, you know, they will come from everywhere for the job.
When you're working with young players, you probably have to teach them a lot.
Have to rehearse a lot and teach a lot. You have to be very patient. But that's also good for me. It's also good for me because if I didn't do that, suppose I had someone who knew everything anyway. I wouldn't rehearse as much, and I wouldn't come up with fresh ideas as much, you know. It's like me writing 30 years, 17 years ago, and also dropping things I wrote 20 years ago. And I tried it out with each group that I had through the years, and I never felt... No one gave me the feeling that they really wanted to tackle it until this year. And when I played Dropping Things for the young musicians that I have today, they were enthusiastic about the tune. And because of their enthusiasm, I hung in there and got something out of the tune.
You strike me as someone who's never allowed themselves to be a victim. And I bring that up because I think... Well, I think a lot of great artists have led tragic lives, have been the victim of either bad management or drugs or just something that either killed them or made them very weak. And you just strike me as someone who's always been kind of strong and independent and has taken charge of things.
Well, you can say that I've pretty much taken charge of my career because I relied on people, on the audience. When they appreciate what I do and appreciated in the past what I did, I decided that that was the way I was going to go. I wasn't ever going to let them down. So whenever I got on the stage, I decided to do a job. I wanted them to be pleased. I wanted them to be satisfied and to have a good time coming to catch me work, whether I had a record out there or not. That was the only way I was going to survive in this business without having a hit record, especially after the mid-60s when hit record was the only way you weren't going to get a record label. You had to become a good performer so that the club owners would rehire you when you got a job because you wanted people to come to catch you work. And if you fill the club up, it make no difference whether you had a hit record or not. The club owner was going to hire you. So that was my job, was to become a good performer and to deal with the music also. And I did. I took a lot of risk on the job. And that, to me, was what people like to see me do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Betty Carter recorded in 1990. Her latest album is called It's Not About the Melody. She has a new live album due out in October. She's currently on a European tour. She performs back in New York in mid-August. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our archive show today was produced by Roberta Sherrock. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin and Roberta Sherrock directed the program. I'm Terry Gross. Let's close with Betty Carter's 1964 recording of Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most.
Spring this year has got me feeling like a horse that never left the post. I lie in my room, staring up at the ceiling. Spring can really hang the most. Morning's kiss wakes trees and flowers into them. I'd like to drink.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
John Cale brought an avant-garde sensibility to rock and roll. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about co-founding the Velvet Underground and his subsequent solo career. He has a new CD retrospective. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.